Welcome to another episode of Rooted in Gwaqwasawin with your hosts, Sam and Matt.
In today's episode, we revisit our conversation with Roger Bowden, who started as health director for Jigging First Nation in 2002. Roger then transitioned to the position of Imnad Demjaget, which he has since retired from and is now pursuing consulting.
Our conversation spans the development of Gwaqwasawin Meekin, the field of Indigenous wellness, self-care, and what it takes to have a long and impactful career in Indigenous healthcare.
Okay, and we're live.
Today we're with Mr. Roger Bowden, long-term health director of Chiging First Nation, and in a new position just as of this month, I believe, of Imnad Demjaget for Chiging First Nation. We've had a long relationship with Raj, working in a lot of different positions, and really excited to have a conversation with him today. Thanks for joining us, Raj.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first off, a lot of this is about telling stories. So can you tell us a little bit about yours?
Well, I was recently retired. I actually retired for about 7 weeks. So I was at the health manager for Chiging First Nation for about 21 years and worked for Chiging for 33 years in total. So decided to take a break. I wanted to try a different challenge in my next chapter. So I actually went back to school in 2019-2020 and went and completed my master's of business administration. So I wanted to pursue consulting and helping out First Nations that are in need, especially in the health system. So took a break. But just recently, we had a new elected chief and council, and our previous Imnad Demjaget had stepped down from his position about a month ago. So I was approached by leadership to fulfill the position for Imnad Demjaget, which is basically the band manager's role. So I've taken over that since November 8th. I'm just on a term position. I was clear it was only going to be a term position, but so I'm there till the end of April of 2024. Mm. So we'll see how it goes. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. I'm not closing the door on any opportunities, but yeah. So going back to my role in as the health manager, we were, I guess, heavily involved in the creation of Gwaqwasawin. It was actually an idea that previous Chief Joe Harebaugh and myself had talked about the addictions in Chiging and the struggles our community members were facing. And what we looked at, we said that the systems that were in place, the mainstream systems, were not working. And we wanted to look at a land-based program, and we had modeled it after, we had looked at modeling it after, I think it was the Pine River.
Pine River Institute.
Yeah, Pine River Institute. So we made a couple of trips down there to look at their treatment system that they had in place and how we could integrate that in more culturally. So yeah, that's where my involvement with Gwaqwasawin came, and then we were fortunate enough to get Sam on board, and I think it took us many trips to Toronto and Ottawa to finally get the government convinced that, you know, look at a different approach of treatment rather than the mainstream approach. So here we are today, and it's really rewarding to see the successes of such a program in our community here. So yeah.
Absolutely.
What do you think, what was the initial driver for moving towards more land-based cultural programming?
I think what we were seeing that the mainstream, like the 28-day program was the basically one of the only programs that was available through public sector, right? You could go through the private sector for more longer term, but of course we didn't have access as First Nation organizations. We weren't privy to have, you know, we couldn't afford the mainstream. So what we were noticing was a lot of people were going for the 28-day program and coming back and then back into that same household, and then it was just a matter of time they were having relapse and back to square one again. So we said, let's look at a different approach, rather, you know, pretty hard, a 28-day program. So we looked at, I know when Sam was in the development of the 90-day out land base, we thought that would be more meaningful to our indigenous population, you know, living off the land, learning the land, learning the medicines, surviving off the land. So we thought that would be more suited towards our culture. Mm-hmm. So that was the route that, the main reason why we wanted to go that route.
Yeah, and it's such a organic and inherently appropriate approach, because when you look at it, that 90 days is typically the length of a season as well. So we've been able to really implement seasonal programming. So you're able to adjust the activities, adjust the campsites, and really focus on living within that natural order, because we've become so disconnected from that natural order where everything is done via tech or the concrete jungle, and we have this urban living and expectation that there's almost this approach of humility, disconnect, and then reconnect to really humble ourselves in our approach. And I think that was kind of one of the expectations in going into this, was really being able to get back to the original elements of being and the original instructions and being within that natural order.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think what we've learned from this as well is, you know, not just in treatment for the land base, but we're also looking at our youth programs, and we're doing it in those four seasons. Like, what can we? And a lot of it is, majority of it is land based programming now. So it's, you know, we've learned off the successes of Gwagwadzawan, and now we're bringing that into our community youth programs. So, you know, we're actually, in the summer, we utilized the Clapperton, the former site of Gwagwadzawan, for our youth programs. We're, this springtime, we're doing the maple syrup, we're doing those kind of events. Winter, we're doing ice fishing, all these things that learning and you know, harvesting what we have here. So yeah, it I think it's flourished, not just for the treatment aspect, but it's kind of revamped our communities into more land-based programs.
What kind of response are you seeing? Is there people that are looking forward to participating in it? Is it kind of herding cats? What's the community?
For the youth program?
Yeah, for the youth program.
Absolutely, they love it. They what we did a couple of years ago as part of the youth program, we did it was a survey. We surveyed from, I believe it was 5 years old right up to 17, 18 year olds, right up to high school. And I believe the top 10 activities they wanted to see were all outdoor activities. So it was really interesting. Yeah. You know, they want to learn the fishing, they want to learn to hunt, they want to do snowshoes, they want to do like all land-based activities. Which was really nice to see, there was very few responses about, you know, learning about more gaming. That was low on the priorities, so it was really rewarding. So we've had a number of successful activities with the youth programs, partnering with other organizations as well, such as NOJ. We bring in NOJ facilitators to help out. We have a Young Warriors, a Little Sisters program in our community that is basically, it's all outdoors. It's all outdoors. We have youth programs. Majority of it is outdoors. We do have some indoor recreational, like basketball and volleyball, stuff like that. But yeah, it's working really well.
When you think back to when Chief Joe Harbaugh started kicking this idea around and you guys started exploring it, do you think Gwagwadzawan's different than it was originally envisioned? Or
no,
what do you think?
No,
do you think it's meeting the needs? Or
I think it's meeting the needs. It was basically, when we talked, we just, it kind of, the way we see it, like, it makes me smile, and I bet you Joe Harbaugh's smiling too. Just seeing how it grabbed the concept that we had talked about, having something different, having something that's going to meet the Anishinaabeg of the island. And I think by seeing those outdoor activities, by actually going out to visit them, and I'm not too sure if Joe Baugh was able to get out and visit some of the sites, but I know I went out to a few times to visit and to actually see some of the participants. And it was really interesting when I went out to Clapperton when we were gifted with a 30-foot canoe. One of the participants came up and actually shook my hand and thanked us for allowing him to utilize the land. And basically, he was saying how it saved his life. Mm. And, you know, hearing those kind of stories, and it just goes with what we envisioned that, I don't even know how many years ago that was, that to be 15 years ago.
Well, I remember working in Chigang around 2010, 2011, and Joe Ba was already bringing Pine River there to come and speak at conferences and stuff. Yep. So it's been an idea for quite a while.
Yeah, it sure has. And it's really nice to see and how much Gwakwaedzwin has grown just since they started. You know, a number of beds we're offering, the aftercare, which is so important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're still seeing that in the First Nation communities that in Chigang, where if a community member chooses to go a different route, say in mainstream, and they're coming back and there's no aftercare in our community. So, you know, and OGWEC has that aftercare program, which I think is crucial to seeing success.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. I think we've come such a long way. I just, you know, when I reflect on it sometimes, you know, we've went in so many different directions, but I think that's trying to meet the needs of where people are at that time and what kind of gaps in services are existing. So, but, you know, I just think, you know, are we keeping with that original intent? So that's nice to hear.
No, I think it's right in line with our original intent was. I remember having those conversations quite regularly with Joe Herbaugh, and we just said we have to do something different. And, you know, we didn't even expect with the opioid crisis that we're in now, right? It wasn't half as bad back then. Yeah. It was more, a lot of it was alcohol, but, you know, we were starting to see that trend towards opioids, and now it's just the opioid crisis everybody's in right now is just, it's devastating to communities to have to go through, and having a program like this, you know, gives them opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And I think about it too, like Joe Herbaugh and you folks on the steering committee back then had so much vision that it's incredible to see it come to fruition. Like, even I remember having a conversation, we were at a steering committee meeting and saying, you know, like, should this just be for UCCMM communities or should it be open broader? And I remember Joe Ba saying, this isn't just a UCCMM community issue. It's broader. Our members travel throughout every community. So if we're going to make a difference and going to make a change, then it needs to be open to everyone. So.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Most of the First Nations are having the same struggles. And I think the steering committee at the time wanted to, you know, if we can start something here and build and, if it provides an opportunity for members, whether it's from far north or far south in Ontario, then by all means, you know, that's helped them.
Yeah. And then I remember Joe Ba saying too, like, you guys are one of the first organizations really going to make this happen, and other communities are going to look to you for it. And that's, you know, that's part of why this podcast exists too, right? Like, that's why we're doing all these different things, like an Indigenous land-based counselor certificate and different training and education opportunities, all from that. And it blows me away that he had that vision at that time.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was at a health managers conference out in Vancouver, and a lot of it was about, you know, meeting other First Nation health managers, and a lot of it was some of the counselors from many of the First Nation communities come. But anyways, at one of the dinners, I was sitting with a group from Saskatchewan and, you know, just socializing, and we started talking about different programs. And they were really struggling with addictions, and they were looking for solutions. Anyways, and I told them about Gwakwaedzwin and some of the successes. I think we were maybe in our second year of operation, and some of the successes and some of the challenges. And they were just so intrigued They said, well, can we bring Quakotwin here? Anyway, so I did send them, I told them that they could contact if they wanted the information. I'm not too sure if they did follow up, but it was interesting. Like, yeah, it was, yeah. they just thought, yeah, why haven't we thought about something mm-hmm. like that?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I find that we get calls weekly with people who are looking for either just tips and tricks of the trade, consultation, advice. That a lot of people are in development for this land-based stuff. And it's interesting because even the language that we use, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said we're doing something different. We're not doing something new or innovative per se. These are original activities that were meant to support wellness and connection and collective sort of living. But it's not new. And I think a lot of times when we look at these issues ahead of us, we start looking forward and we stop to think about where we came from, and all of the things that we need are in our own backyard to create success.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, what the last 10 years at working at the health center, we found a real trend of our community members wanting to go back to traditional medicines. Mm-hmm. Like, the traditional medicine request is just phenomenal now. So, you know, if we're having treatment centers like this, you know, it's learning those medicines and what they can do, getting away from, you know, from the Western medicines, not getting away, but kind of, you know, giving them that opportunity for, they could make that choice if they wanted to use traditional medicines. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's we have so much to offer within our mm-hmm. lands here, mm-hmm. just on Manitoulin. Yeah.
I'm curious, in your role through health leadership, how did you balance those two worlds of, you know, that initial Western prescriptive?
Yeah, that was always a topic of that we engaged in. But what we always promoted to our community members was, it's your choice. You know, if you want to go with the Western medicines, that's fine. But we want to make sure you have the information on both, providing that information, that knowledge about what our medicines here can do, our natural medicines. But yeah, and we, back in when I first started, back in 2002, they had one of the doctors, Dr. Bailey, and he worked with, he was part of the Mequatoxigic Council, I think that's what it was called. He worked with one of the late chief of Wicomicon. Oh geez, it's bugging me that. But they were instrumental in bringing that, I guess, the opportunity for members to choose between Western and traditional medicines. They were the ones that opened up the you know, so people can smudge in the hospital here on the island. Mm-hmm. So it was very, it was a learning experience. And I sat on the council for about 2 years with them, and I learned so much mm-hmm. from these two gentlemen that, it was just great listening and how they were connecting between, you know, you have a mainstream physician and then you had a knowledge keeper. But how they blend it together to mm-hmm. to make it work, mm-hmm. and we see a lot of that resemblance from in today.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
And I think this kind of builds on what you were just saying. But how would you say First Nations Indigenous healthcare has changed since 2002 when you started?
Well, it's grown quite. I remember with starting at Chigang Health Center. just the size of our operational budget and the staffing that we had access to was very minimal. It was very limited to the services we could provide. Now today, you know, we're looking at providing home care, long-term care. We're doing a lot of prevention programs, or diabetes awareness. A lot of these programs that where we would have one CHN or one CHR providing multiple services, and it just wasn't meeting the needs of the community. So now we have access to more resources. We have with the creation of Nochin Win Tech, you know, brought that gap of services that was missing, especially in primary care, mm-hmm. To First Nations. We were able to get with Noj, we were able to get our own physicians coming from Noj, our nurse practitioners. We had a psychologist coming in, and then we had a whole diabetes team. So it was bringing more and more services that we didn't have. You know, we had, if you even look prior to when I started, when we used to have basically one CHR mm-hmm. running our healthcare system. So, and that was only in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So we've grown quite substantially.
So to build on that question, where do you see Indigenous health going next?
I see a lot of, I think there's going to be challenges. Obviously, you know, we're still dependent on government funding, right? And then that's always going to be a concern. And whenever there's potentially a change in government, there's always, you know, some red flags that come up about what are we going to have access to. But I see opportunity as well. I see opportunity for expanding, you know. One day I would like to see that we do have a full-time physician in our community. We have a full-time nurse practitioner. I think those days are coming. And how much we've grown in the last 20 years, I think. I see it a lot of positives, but I see there's going to be challenges, you know, with the current deficit are over, you know, our country's in right now.
Yeah.
There's going to be some serious concerns, right?
Do you see a point where, and maybe you're doing a bit of this now, but with the population boom within the community as well, where things go to more of a proactive than a reactive measure? And what are some of the attempts at doing some of that work?
Yeah, I've always, I always don't like the reactive when we respond in reactive mode, right? And we've talked about this when we did our planning sessions, and Sam will probably remember one of the things we always promote, even in, especially in mental health. I don't know if you remember Danny's, one of his lines when he was talking about, when we talk about services we're doing, he was saying that 80% of our services in mental health was reactive. We were dealing with crisis all the time, and about 20% was dealing with preventive services. Mm-hmm. What he wanted to do is flip that around so that we were doing 80% of our program, like our staffing, should be in preventive, mm-hmm. and only like the smaller part, 20% or less, should be in reaction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So trying to build that, but, you know, we still can't get away with, especially in mental health and addictions, is we're still in a crisis. Yeah. Where we can't hide the fact that, you know, many of our community members are struggling mm-hmm. with opioids and continue to struggle with it. Mm-hmm. So it's very concerning. Chigging did declare a state of a social emergency back mm-hmm. in 2020. So they haven't, it's still a standing declaration that hasn't been declared over yet. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we continue to still have struggles. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to that proactive approach? Yeah. You know, we got to get into the schools. We got to start with the younger, you know, with prenatal. Yeah. We have to, start getting those teachings, those opportunities to our community members.
Yeah, approach it from that all stages of life aspect.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I think it sounds like you're doing a lot of the right things and that the buy-in is there with some of the youth too, so I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what was your youth like? And did you develop an affinity for being outdoors younger, or is that something that came later?
Yeah, it's quite different when we were kids. you know, it was all outdoors.
We
didn't have programs and services there to put programs on. It was all, you know, we would meet to play Indian ball. We'd have 40 kids, like four nights a week playing Indian ball down at our, right downtown at our, in front of our church. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have an outdoor rink. We played hockey on the lagoon. we made ice wherever we could. It was so different. Like, it was road hockey was everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was just so much different. Today, you don't see kids playing road hockey. You don't see them, you know, they complain of the outdoor rinks not shoveled off. You know, it's just a different generation, right? But yeah, back then we as soon as you got home off the bus, you dropped your stuff and you were you're back for supper and maybe and back for bedtime. It was quite different.
Yeah. Well, I remember even being up here for summers, and you guys had the best driveway for road hockey too. So everyone would show up at your place.
Yeah, it was a community event for sure. We used to have, where I grew up, it was part of Billings Township, and so we'd have Billings against Chigging. We had big competitions there. So we'd have. It was quite exciting. Mm.
What other kind of seasonal activities did you get into as a kid? Like, what did the winters look like?
Winters obviously was road hockey was our big one, and ice hockey. We all played, everybody played ice hockey back then. Not so much about ice fishing, wasn't as popular. I think it's more popular today. But it was all physical activities, though. Like, I know with my late brother, Mike, he was very heavy into snaring during the winter, and he was always out snaring, and he loved that kind of activities. The big thing in the winter, obviously, and people that did have snow machines, sliding was very popular. Things like that. But the ice fishing wasn't as popular back then. Yeah.
Now you look at Lake Minde Moyne, it's like a little village, just have its own.
Oh, you wouldn't believe that. Yeah, it's like a little town out there. Yeah.
So you definitely played an important role in our formation, but you were certainly integral in some other organizations too. I'm thinking of GHL and Kinigabeshimi as well. So could you talk a little bit about those and why that type of work is important for a health director to
broaden? Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I could talk about GHL. Kinna was one of Joe Ba's, one of his creations and organizations that he created as well. So that was already in the makings by the time I got here. But for GHL, so actually started with Chigging and UCSM as well. So that had started back in the early 2000s when we talked about the number of medical records in each health center. You know, for example, in our health center, if you walked in, you could have any individual in the community can have a nursing chart, they can have a mental health chart, they can have a transportation chart, they can have a home care chart. I think we counted 7 or 8 charts one individual had in our health center. And we said, how can we amalgamate or merge those into, you know, one chart to provide a service that's going to be beneficial to the community member? So we were missing the boat when it came to electronic medical records. That, you know, most of the family health teams, hospitals, mainstream health organizations were all already on electronic medical records. So it took many years convincing the federal government that we needed this on First Nations. So what we did was we created the organization. It was just, it's a lot of similarities to Wiquatsun. It was a steering committee. So what we did was we brought in a steering committee of representations for all of Manitoulin. And then the North Shore seen the work that we were doing. And so we invited North Shore to join GHL as well. So we had a 6-person steering committee, 3 from Manitoulin and 3 from the North Shore. So what we did was we negotiated with federal government, with FINIM for, I think it was 4 or 5 years. And we had hired a consultant, a guy by the name of Murray Dion, that developed their business plan. Mm-hmm. And we presented that plan numerous times. Murray, myself, we even got Grand Chief Pat Madabi helping us, just like Pat was helping absolutely. Us instrumentally in getting the funding for Kwekwatsuwin as well. So what we got to the point where they were really railroading in our committee, and we almost lost it. I think everybody was ready to throw in the towel because they just keep giving us little tokens just to keep the discussions going. And then finally, when we finally were able to convince FINIP that, you know, this is something we need, we were able to fund it, and then we went to an incorporated board as well. So yeah, and it's thriving today. The organization is really thriving. We have 14 First Nations. We've also assisted other organizations in getting them up and running in EMRs. I know they had a contract with North Bay.
Okay.
So yeah, they're really really doing well.
It seems like there's this fundamental shift that's happening too, where in years past or generations past, we've seen different concepts of Indigenous programming, where we've sometimes had Western programming delivered by First Nations people, and then it seems like we're in this shift of more Indigenized approaches and philosophies that are being embedded. What do you think a community-driven Indigenous program looks like in this day and age?
Well, it's got to come from the community, right? It's got to be, like, each community has similarities, but they're different. And what I mean is, you know, the language could be a little different. Their upbringing could be a little bit different. You know, if you're more remote or you're more closer to an urban setting, there's going to be differences in each community. So I think it's important to understand the community's needs. And the best way is by working with the community members that have lived there. To bring those, you know, those needs and desires forward to develop a program that's going to work. We've had programs, you know, coming in from outside organizations that didn't flourish. You know, they tried, they attempted, and they were there for short term, and then they basically folded. So I think I look at when Kwekwazun was developed, and I think Sam can attest to that, is it looked at not just Pine River, but what the islands needs or what we had to offer here, you know, utilizing different parts of Manitoulin, you know, utilizing Clapperton as a kind of semi-remote location. Just moving that around parts of the island, I think it captures all different aspects of the island as well. So yeah, I think it has to be community driven, and listening to our elders that have lived it, utilizing our knowledge keepers. So yeah.
No, I think that's and that's something that I think I've seen a big shift into over the years, is that it used to just be this blanket approach to everything. We're going to roll out this provincial program or this federal program, but now that you have the communities involved, exactly as you said, you get to see the nuances and the various needs based on so many different variables.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's just it too, just like you were mentioning with the Saskatchewan community too. We've had lots of places ask us, can we just bring Kwekwazun in here? And that's always my response to it. I was like, I don't know if it'll work. Like, you know, you got to meet your community needs. Like, everywhere is going to be different. We've been fortunate, like you said, that we've had the community buy-in from each of the First Nation communities to use the incredible land resources that we have here. Not everywhere has that. And we've got a lot of amazing partners to be able to partner with Chigging Health Center, to be able to partner with Nojmuinteg or Namadzuin and those different health centers, to partner with Kenchkawinteg. Like, to have that education as part of aftercare has been an incredible resource for our participants. So I don't know if the GWEC model could be just that cookie cutter approach. And we always say that we're not taking that cookie cutter approach, and it's about being participant-centered, so I don't know if you could even franchise it
You'd have to adapt to that area, right?
Yeah.
I still remember talking to the late Gordy Wandemans. He used to stop and visit me at the health center a few times, and I've always cherished having those discussions with him. And one of the things he always talked about was, we have medicines here, but it's for our Anishinaabeg people. He said, it's a touchy subject when you go into a different territory, when you talk about medicines, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said those medicines were here for the Anishinaabeg.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I always took that to heart. And you know, like you said, it may not work in Saskatchewan.
Yeah. And I think we've also seen the exploitation of natural resources explode in the last few decades, really. So even you're seeing the over-harvesting of sweetgrass in areas and things like that. So if you create this opportunity where it becomes provincially accessible or beyond the territory that it's meant to serve, then you're starting to lose some of those sustainability aspects and paying it forward for seven generations.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm speaking as an alumni of the Elite Hockey Institute, but wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that. You know, you had a lot of community endeavors outside of your profession, and why is that important to you to do those sorts of things for your community and beyond? And why might that be important for other up-and-coming health leaders to find different ways to give back to community?
Yeah, that was a really fun project that I was involved with. It actually, with the Elite Hockey Institute, was a buddy of mine I grew up with, and I played hockey with, through minor hockey with a guy by the name of Garden East. And he was, he still works in the hockey, he's still a hockey agent today, but he was working for one of the agents by the name of Michael Barnett at the time, who was an agent for some of the top hockey players in the NHL at the time, including like Jeremy Yager, and I think even Wayne Gretzky might have been one of his. So he had some pretty top caliber, this Michael Barnett. So what Garnett's role was, he was more into the scouting, like he was looking at the junior players and getting them into the NHL, and he still had, like one of his best friends was Joe Thornton, who had a long career with Boston and San Jose. Anyways, it was something that Garnett and I had discussions. We said, you know, let's look at bringing a hockey school back to the island. Because when we were kids, they had a hockey school back in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we it was actually by the late chief, James Dabosky, that brought a hockey school in partnership with the Sudbury Wolves.
Oh, wow.
So Joe Drago and his team, with they provided a hockey school, and I was one of the participants, and so was Garnett.
Yeah.
So we really liked what it did for, you know, bringing that hockey atmosphere to the community. Growing up in a hockey community, you know, like Friday nights was senior hockey in Chigging was huge. Like the arena was packed, everybody was at the arena. So we wanted to try to bring that back into the community because it was starting to phase out. So in the early 90s, we brought Garnett, was him and Barnett were agents for a number of players, including Owen Nolan, Chris Simon, one of our Ojibwe brothers from Wawa, who was able to come down and help out with the hockey school, and a number of NHL players we were able to bring in for the hockey school. We ran it for about, I think, 3 or 4 years. It was, it ran very well, and it was just a pleasure to see the expression on the kids' faces and how they enjoyed, you know, meeting. And actually, at that school, we still continue with Randy Carlisle, still came in and helped out,
right?
Which he had he's a camp here on Manitoulin, so we were able to convince him to come out and help out as well.
Yeah, so I remember Owen Nolan being there, and some OHL players too. And there's a player from Boston, I can't remember his name too.
Darren Banks?
He had a cut across the back from a skate across the back.
That was Darren Banks.
Yeah. Those are definitely some standout memories for me.
Mm-hmm. One of the standout memories that I had was we had a charity hockey game. So we put a pretty good hockey team from the island together, and we played against them, the NHL players and the junior A players. So we had, it was not going to be any contest, right? they were just playing anyways. But during the game, I think they let me, but they gave me a breakaway from the red line. And I was all excited. I'm going to, you know, I got a breakaway on Olympic goalie Manny Legacy. I had 100 different moves I would think I was going to do. And I got to the blue line and I tripped. And the arena was packed. And anyways, my line mates couldn't stop laughing. They all had to go out. I still get teased over, and that was like 30 years ago. I still get teased over that.
Really, legends never die.
Another funny episode in the in that game was right off the bat. Again, the arena's packed, and the guy from Boston is Darren Banks. He was one of the tough guys. He was, you know, considered one of the goons back then, right? Anyways, he's nicest guy you can meet off the ice, like super nice guy, and got to know him and everything. And so we're lining up at the start of the game. I'm on the wing. He's on the wing, and he says, "Come on, Bowden, let's put on a show." Says, "Drop the gloves," he says. I wasn't gonna fall for that. It was funny, but we had a good time.
Yeah, I look back fondly on those two, and what I really remember fondly is just the community aspect. Like, whether you were a kid or whether you were playing or you were too young to be or too old to be on the ice, everyone was at those arenas, and it was just a jovial, collective experience altogether. And even through high school, I remember we would have that as well. We would go play our high school games on Friday night, and you'd have almost 400 people out there watching. It was the whole community.
Growing up from back in the 70s, like the intermediate seed of senior hockey on the island was huge. Every arena was it was packed, like whether it was Chigang, Wicomicon, Little Current, it was packed, and there was some really heated rivalries. And like it was but we looked forward, like like growing up, that was the thing you looked forward to. Friday night, we're going to the arena. I'm gonna go watch senior hockey.
And even if it's not hockey and it's evolved to something else, I think the key takeaway from that is having that purpose, hope, and belonging. You have that drive to be there Friday night. You have that competitive edge. You're with your teammates, and it's something that you're not going through alone. And there's so many parallels to even our mental wellness journeys and our mental health journeys, in that we're sometimes so siloed now. And the pandemic did nothing to help that by making everyone sort of isolate and stay at home. We became connected through phones and computers. And I think we're really at that point where we're starting to do that shift of that genuine, authentic connection again.
It was interesting back in the 90s when we ran the EHI hockey school, one of the instructors was Claire Alexander. He was actually a coach for Toronto Maple Leafs for a season or two. But he was also a defenseman for them in his playing days. But having lunch with him one day, we were just talking about, you know, how hockey is not just a sport, it brings a community together. He says that there's two things that'll bring a community together. He says, a crisis or a winning team. And if you think about it, when you have, you know, a crisis always brings, when there's tragedy, it brings the community together. But if you have, like, a team that excels, I remember, like, the old senior hockey days, it brought everybody together. So I was just, I said, I really, I could really understand his, unfortunately, the Leafs haven't won the Cup.
They're not bringing the city together.
Those are diehards.
Well, actually, I think they do bring the city together because everybody's just miserable together and commiserate together about it. That's funny. No, that's, and I mean, it's a gathering place too, right? Like, I've been bringing the kids to swim lessons in Espanola, and that complex that they have there is such a gathering place for a community, right? And they're a community going through a tough time right now, but they have that place, and you know, you see people, even the adults there, gathering, having that time to get together while they're watching the kids play hockey or go to swim lessons or different things. And it's that sense of community, which, like you said, we've gotten away from in this digital age.
The sense of community, we have to try to figure a way, how do we bring that back, right?
What are you doing to bring some of that back or remain connected? Is there any particular activities or events?
Well, we're trying to really engage with our youth program again. So that's, I think for the last number of years, it's always been one of our leadership priorities is providing programs and services. I think it was only about 5-6 years ago, we didn't have a full-time youth worker. Now we have actually 3 youth workers in Chigang now. So we're starting to see it build back up, and it's just, you know, it's not gonna change overnight. It just takes, you know, how do we get them engaged again? And then COVID hit too, right? Where COVID put everybody back, 2.5 years where everybody was isolated. So re-engaging, you know, I look at these, especially the young kids that are, you know, that were, you know, 6 months to a year old when COVID hit. How do we get them involved where they have to stay home for that? You know, those are very important learning years for children's development. So, but I think over the long run, hopefully we'll get people back engaged and building that that community atmosphere again. So,
you've had a very long career. Part of the story we're trying to tell is, you know, that of wellness and taking care of yourself. How do you do that over the course of a career? How do you ensure that you're staying healthy to do the work that you need to do?
Yeah, that's always a tough one. My wife might tell you a different story. she says I don't listen to her suggestions or her diet that she wants to put me on. But I think a lot of it is a balance, right? You have to, one of the things that I struggled was leaving my work at work. You know, once you clock out, try not to bring that work home. To balance, we have to have balance in life. You don't really learn that till the latter part of your career, and I think it, you know, it you have to learn that. I think we got to start teaching that for younger people, is balance their life. You know, you can't be on call 24/7, and one of the things, yeah, otherwise you're going to be on blood pressure pills, and you know, it takes a toll on your health. And that physical activity, you gotta, you know, once you getting out for a walk, just to, whether it's not just for exercise, but it clears your mind and stuff. Finding what's gonna work for you, I think. Some people read a book, which clears the mind. Some people want to go for a walk. Some people, you know, finding the one thing that it's gonna help you.
And I think that you're a model for lifelong learning as well. So what was that like going back to school? Was that 30 some years later?
Yeah, it was, to be honest, it was quite the struggle. It was, you know, I think it was 35 years in between my schooling. But it was something I wanted to do. I just kind of put it off. And this opportunity came up through Australia. And it was geared towards individuals that had full-time management positions, so you went at your own pace. But once you committed to one of the courses, you had to commit for the 8 weeks for each course you did take. So, yeah, it was a learning curve. The first two subjects I took, I kind of said, "What the heck am I getting into?" but yeah, I stuck it out. I did have to, and then COVID hit, right? So I didn't think that we were going to be as busy as we were, you know, at the start of the pandemic. And then, so I did have to take a little break from my schooling during COVID, but I re-engaged once things settled down. And yeah, and fortunately, I was able to graduate this past February. Oh, so
congratulations.
I was pretty happy about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank
That's
you.
Incredible.
Do you have any advice for people who are sort of struggling with some of that balance? I mean, you talked a little bit about that, and sometimes it just, no matter what you do, you carry it with you, especially in this line of work.
Yeah, it's something I really struggled with for probably the first 15 years of working in the health, bringing my work home and not taking that balance. But I tell you, you have to learn that at the early stage, because it could take its toll just mentally, and it affects you physically. Being able to, you know, we should have a switch where you can turn that switch off at whether it's 4:30, 5 o'clock, and then concentrate on your family life, right? But it's so important to, and then you need those supports at home, right? Those supports that they understand your work life, they understand that but there's that expectation once you're home, you're supposed to be home. Not just physically, but you have to be home mentally as well. Yeah. So, it's, I think the the more mature, the older you get, you, mm-hmm. you start to realize how important that is.
Mm-hmm.
But and maybe that's something that we can, you know, stress that as employers, mm-hmm. we have to not expect employees to be on call all the time mm-hmm. And you know, providing that service.
Mm-hmm. We did a mindfulness exercise at our staff meeting yesterday where individuals were asked to close their eyes, and the facilitator walked us through a scenario where you were sitting in a chair, 80 years old, and looking back in that sort of future reflection lens, what were the things that you did too much of?
Yep.
And most of the stuff coming back was, I invested everything into work, and you miss the time when the kids are young and these types of things, and you don't get that time back. So really, I think being mindful of it, but being able to create space to have those conversations is important as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you can't, you know, once your child gets to a certain age, it's, you want to make sure you had that opportunity to be part of their development, right? Taking them to hockey games, you know, helping them with reading and stuff like that at home. But yeah, it's you can't replace those.
No. I'm curious too, have you seen, I mean, because you've done the work for a while, did you see an evolution of how culture and language was infused into the programming?
Yeah, it's really come back. Culture and language is a big part. As you know, in Chigging, there's a declaration that by 2030, they want to be an Ojibwe-speaking community. So all our services are having that expectation that they can at least understand, they could carry a general conversation in the language. Our school, we actually, we just did a tour of our school this morning with our new Gama and our deputy. And we were very pleased with the amount of language that they're investing in our school right now.
Mm-hmm.
Every classroom we went in, there's, you know, it's all, there's language posters. And so we're striving to have those, give the students those opportunities to learn the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's so important to bring that back.
Mm-hmm.
Back when we went to school, we didn't have as much of a language program when I was going to school, in our elementary school. And it was almost, you know, in our class alone, I think we had maybe two speakers.
Oh, wow.
in our class.
Hmm.
So it was very unfortunate that we didn't have as many language speakers, but I think I'm hopeful that it is gonna come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's key too, is not to sprinkle it on and have it just as a piece of curriculum, but that repeat exposure and that ability to just engage from that community level in school, out of school. When we worked with the Friendship Centers many years ago, there was a push for language programming, and what they saw as the biggest detriment to that sustainability and that success was going home and then not being exposed to it. So you might have that hour or two, yep, where you see it, but then a lot of it becomes undone or it's not reinforced through afterwards.
Exactly. It's having that at home and then at school. I recall Neil Dubosky talking about even a childhood's development in education. You know, they're only at school, I think he said it, if you look at it throughout the whole year, they're only at school about 10% mm-hmm. of the time. So in 10%, so they're like, I think it was 80 some percent, they're at home. So we can't totally rely on the school for, you know, teaching mm-hmm. the language and
yeah.
all the education.
Yeah,
we have to bring that part of the home. So
mm-hmm.
it goes for language just the same.
Yeah.
Look at many of our fluent language speakers now. Majority of them learned mm-hmm. that from home.
Yeah. It's funny too, and you're seeing this, the sort of change in the pendulum too. I remember when we were going into school, it was always, you have to learn French, being in Canada, those are the two languages. If you want to be employable, you need to learn French. And now all the job descriptions such saying Anishinaabemowin is an asset. So it's amazing to actually see it in application
yeah.
where we live.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we even had a French class in Lakeview School when we were growing up for, I think it was 1 year.
Yeah.
We had a French language class.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So you've, with the short term retirement that you had there, you were diving into some angling. How was the fishing this summer?
Yeah, it was awesome. Mm-hmm. It was the best summer I had for the 7 weeks that I was retired, I was out fishing. I think I got out about 28 times last summer. Wow. So yeah, we had a fish fry at least once a week for the whole summer.
That's awesome.
So when I did start going back to work, I started my consulting back in July. Mm-hmm. So I was working only 2 to 3 days a week until I took this up in November.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really have a passion for fishing now. It's I'm hooked.
Hook, line, and sinker. Yeah. Can you walk us through that and maybe some of the feelings of going out to harvest and the satisfaction of actually frying that fish that you pulled from the lake?
It's, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you have fish and chips, I find it's no comparison to having your own. You know, you go out, you catch your fish with your family and friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. You come home, you clean the fish and you fry it right there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that you can buy in a restaurant that is gonna, it's not gonna be the same.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was very fortunate to do a lot of fishing with, you know, with my wife, and mostly our grandkids came out with us this summer. So it was really nice to enjoy it. It's not just about fishing, it's about the quality time too that you have out there with your family, right?
Yeah.
So, and then the bonus is if you get some fish and you have a nice fry, that's what we look at as the bonus part of it.
Yeah,
so. Absolutely.
You're good? Awesome, yeah. So that we're pretty much wrapping up. We've hit all of our marks, but is there any final advice that you'd give to any leaders out there within the health field in terms of where we can keep our eyes on the prize or what you've learned through your time?
The one thing I've always said as a manager is never close a door, right? Is always leave those doors open. And I even practice it in my own office. I leave my door open, so even though, unless it was confidential, private talk, a personnel issue or something. But having that, don't close the doors to opportunities, is what I've always envisioned. And don't burn your bridges. Those things can come back and bug you later on when you try to go down, cross that bridge again.
Yeah.
So
but
that's one of the things I've learned. Don't close your doors and, you know, don't burn too many bridges that you may need in the later parts of your life.
Yeah, and I think it's important to hear that too, because sometimes when you see young leaders, you get so focused on the now and you're not thinking of that 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
That's right,
Awesome.
No, it's good. I'm hoping to retire again next year. So
awesome. Well, miigwech for all your insight and wisdom today.
And
yeah, it was awesome having you in the podcast.
Thank you.
I have to say, I really like Roger's advice of not closing doors and not to burn bridges. I think to have longevity in the healthcare field, that's really something you need to consider, particularly in our case, it being a rural context. You know, you never know if someone leaves an organization when you might have to work with them in another. But it also reminds me of another thing that Chief Joe Harbaugh shared with Roger and I one time on a car ride home from a funding meeting. We were talking about feeling frustrated and different things within the context of our careers. And he told us how when he's feeling frustrated, he doesn't really get hung up on it. He just puts that person into a parking lot and then he's able to move on with his day from there. And that's something I've tried to put into practice in my career since then. You know, it doesn't always work. Sometimes you're in the moment or crisis or something needs to be resolved right away. But when you can put that into practice, I found it really helpful, because later when you're dealing with it, you know, it's taking the emotion out of it, you know, taking that moment, taking that pause, being able to collect yourself. So I think that's some really sound advice for moving forward in your career as well.
That is definitely some sage wisdom that stems from an illustrious career. Moving from that parking lot metaphor to one of a roadmap, next episode we speak with former Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, Michael Tobolo, and his ministry's plan to build Ontario's mental health and addiction system entitled Roadmap to Wellness. We hope you enjoyed this episode and will join us next week for some more great conversations. Until then, Bum Up E. If you'd like to learn more about the program, please visit our website, www.gwec.ca.